trust is a fundamental issue, okay? Mm. If you don't trust the person who's tying you and you're not enough to relax and let go and let your body flow with it and get out of your mind and into your body, it basically defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Okay. So it is really important that if one wants to get tied, they do a little bit of homework to make sure that, you know, the person knows what they're doing and, you know, are safe, you know. And this is over and above all kinds of, you know, consent and other things, because when someone gets tied and has that amount of trust, they are extremely vulnerable.
Welcome to the Sensuality Empowerment Show. I am your host, Sharon Hoffman. I have the absolute pleasure to use this platform as an opportunity to connect with guests from all over the world to discuss and share all my favorite topics related to love, sex, relationships, spirituality, and so much more. I want you to feel empowered, excited, and encouraged with the conversations I have, so nothing is off limits. Get yourself comfy and ready for another heartfelt or juicy episode. Welcome back to the show and welcome back to another juicy and heartfelt episode. If you are curious and fascinated by the intrinsic beauty of Shibari, then you're going to love this conversation with Avalon and Jenna. This is an episode that brings me a lot of joy to share with you as I get to introduce my dear friends, a couple who I absolutely love and admire, and friends who were able to provide me with my own personal experience with Shibari a number of years ago. Shibari, also referred to as Japanese rope bondage, is a unique and sensual art form that originated in Japan. It was originally developed as a form of capture, torture, or presentation of prisoners by the samurai, but it has developed over time into a sensual art form. Shibari is about the intimate connection with the rigger and receiver, which Avalon explains in this interview. Seduced by the sensual skills and artistic expression of Shibari, Avalon has developed his own distinctive style of tying, and he gets to share this on stage with his beautiful partner, Jenna. When you see these two performing, they truly take you on a magical journey and you witness the art of surrendering. Many people associate Shibari as kink, but it's so much more than that, which Avalon explains beautifully. Shibari literally translates to tie or to bind, and it involves tying intricate and beautiful knots and patterns used to restrain and give sensation to the body. If you are curious about Shibari, especially the history, why people are drawn to this Japanese rope bondage, the importance of trust in your rigor, and the healing behind surrendering in this process of rope, Avalon and Jenna have this all covered. As you will hear in this interview, they are all about spreading the rope love within the community with their events, workshops, and one-on-one sessions. Keep an eye out for Jenna's latest project, which she reveals towards the end of this interview. So without wasting any more time, here are the beautiful duo, Jenna and Avalon. Hello, beautiful people.
Hi, darling. So good to see you.
So great to connect with you both finally like this. Yeah.
Well, thank you for asking us. Good morning.
We've been hard to pin down.
You guys have been hard to pin down, but I finally pin you down.
Normally it's the other way around for us.
Yeah, true that. I'm really excited to have this conversation with two of my dear friends to speak on all things Shibari, but also I'm sure we'll cover a lot more as things start to unravel in our conversation. But look, Shibari is referred to as Japanese rope bondage. It's used for sexual pleasure. However, I see it more as this beautiful Japanese art form, and I'm feeling it's getting a lot more in that sort of reputation or that feel in the community now. It's kind of moving away from that BDSM type scene, and it's becoming more of this this beautiful sensual performance. So I'm looking forward to discussing this with you both today, and I want to start with you, Avalon. I mean, you're known for your very distinctive style, having your kind of own flavor in the Shibari world. So, and I have personally had the opportunity to experience a session, a beautiful journey with you. So I would love for you to kind of share, how did you get on this journey to becoming a teacher and also doing these beautiful performances and becoming the rigger that you are today?
It's a pretty long story, but I'll try and keep it short. The first time I saw Shibari was in 1985 in Paris, of all places. Was invited to a party there, and they had as guests this Japanese couple, and they did this performance. And I was basically blown away by the beauty, the aesthetics, the sensuality, the erotic power that this performance had, without it being sleazy or pornographic or anything. It was just beautiful watching. So at that point, the real story that hooked me up was...
What you can't say that just happened right now is that I looked at him and that look was to say, tell the whole story. So now you're going to get the whole story.
This party was actually put on by an aunt of a girlfriend of mine, this French girl. And she was very stiff, very sort of rigid and stiff and quite cold. But when I saw that, as the moment this rigger put rope over this woman's body, she sort of melted. And so I thought, oh, that's a very interesting reaction to it. So I suggested to my friend to try and get tied. And the Japanese agreed. And as he did lay rope on her, she also melted. So at that point, I decided I needed to learn that trick. Ignition. The beginning of my journey. But at the time, there was no internet, so very, very difficult to find out anything about it or any information. So it wasn't until a few years later I ended up going to Tokyo and spent a month there for work, not for rope, but I started my research. And after being thrown out of many bars and clubs as no gaijin in here, it's not for you, I eventually sort of crossed paths with this beautiful woman, half French-Canadian and half Japanese, whom had just gone through what I had. But she learned to speak fluent Japanese, and so she was accepted in the inner circle because it was all sort of fairly underground. It was very underground at that point. And through her, I was then lucky enough to be introduced to some people within the Shibari network. And it was then took me another few years to get accepted as a student, because at that point they only saw Westerners as curious people that came over once and never went back. So the masters just couldn't be bothered. And then I think it was in 2008 that I actually ended up getting accepted as a student, and have been going back there once or twice a year ever since. So, and I've been very lucky in my journey. I've sort of cross paths with most of the Shibari and Kimbaku masters and have developed great relationship with them. So now Jen and I go back, at least once a year.
This year.
Bar to 2020 that we will put in the forget fire. And interact, and basically we jam, like musicians jam with other musicians. We rope jam with other Japanese masters.
Yeah, so beautiful. When was the moment that you knew that you felt confident enough as a rigger to go out there and actually practice or do performances and actually do workshops, you know, be more of a teacher? Like, when did you know that you kind of come into your own to be able to, yeah, to hold your own as a rigger?
As it wasn't my intention initially to teach or to do anything like that. It took me a few number of years. As I said, I started getting formal training from a master in 2008, and it wasn't until about 2011 that with two friends in Sydney, we started the Sydney Rope Dojo, and that evolved into a school with over 400 students in a number of years. And through that, we then invited a lot of Japanese masters to Australia, and we toured with them, teaching and hosting workshops. So the actual teaching side of it was, you know, it took me about 4 or 5 years until I sort of was comfortable enough to feel I had something to share.
Yeah. Was I right in mentioning earlier that it was, I mean, it's very much, was more so in the BDSM scene?
Look, yes, you are sort of right. Although there's a lot more depth and there's a lot more to it than sort of just sort of placing it in the BDSM or in the performance world or in the art form. Mm-hmm. It's all of that and more. The BDSM was definitely one of the, let's call it fields or whatever, that sort of embraced it first, just because of the nature of it. But in many ways, it was also misunderstood through that. And it is, just seeing it as BDSM practice is really limiting, as it is just seeing it as a performance art is very limiting, as it is just seeing it as a... it is a lot more esoteric than that. The best way I have to describe it is one of the most intense, intimate and profound ways to interact with someone else. Now, that can happen in many different ways and in many different depths, depending on what intent you have with that person. And that person can be a total stranger, a friend, a lover, family, or whoever, really. Because it's not what you do with rope, is how you do it that matters. So it really depends on what that interaction is.
Can I take us back, for those who are listening right now and don't know too much about Shibari, can you kind of touch on the history and how it was created?
I'll try and be as brief as possible because it sort of spans across a few centuries. First of all, what has been said, Shibari in Japanese means to tie. So out of context, if you say to someone, I do Shibari, they might ask if you work for the post because you're tying parcels or something. And because literally Shibari means to tie. As Kimbaku, which is the other sort of name, means to bind tightly. And again, out of context, no one would even know what you're talking about. In context, it's pretty well understood. It is an underground practice, a little bit like pole dancing was 15 years ago. Now, every second housewife does pole dancing for her birthday party. Kind of scenario, right? So it is coming out. It's coming out also thanks to, you know, however bad films it was, 40 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, 50 Shades.
I felt they missed a few, so I always call it 40. But 50 Shades of Grey, it basically allowed people to talk about it.
Yeah. Like,
it gave people a sort of an excuse to talk about kink. And I believe that everybody's got fantasies and kinks deep down inside, and most people are just too ashamed to talk about it. So I welcomed that film for that reason, because it sort of gave the excuse for people to, hey, what do you think about this? Well, let's have a look at that without feeling grotty or like a pervert. Now, Shibari, the origin of Shibari goes back to the samurai. Now, the main reason is that Japan has very little iron. So the little iron that they had was not used for restraints, shackles, or handcuffs, because it's just too valuable. So they used it for weapons, swords, and it's one of the reasons why there's such a cult about blades and swords, because the simple metal, the iron necessary for them was very valuable. And tools. When it came to restraint, they used rope, because they had plenty of jute and they used rope. Ironically, even still today, the Tokyo police force have a hank of rope in their ordinance. And in some small country towns, they even bring prisoners in court tied up with rope. Okay?
Wow.
It is, and rope, as you probably well know, is used in so many ways in Japan, in ceremonies, in traditional costumes, in traditional decorations and things. There's quite a cult about rope and of all sorts, you know, rice rope, straw rope, hemp rope, jute rope,
and coconut rope,
and all kinds of different ropes. Anyhow, these samurais were a little bit the equivalent of our knights. Okay, they worked basically for the different shoguns or warlords, and they acted as local police force or their own private army. The emperor on the other side had his own army, but he was a bit of a stingy bastard, and he thought it was such a privilege for them to work for him, so he clothed them, fed them, armed them, and housed them, but he didn't pay them much money. So anyone that was any good at swordsmanship would aspire to become a samurai that on the other side were very highly regarded, even in the social scale. You know, there was the emperor, the priests, the noblemen, the doctors, the samurais, and the farmers, and the tradesmen, etc., etc. So not only they earned a lot of money, they had a social status. Okay. So what happened is these samurais, when they acted as police force, if they caught an assassin or a thief, they would tie him up and expose him in the public square. Now, people walking past could understand the severity of their crime by how they were tied. And so they knew if they were to throw tomatoes or rocks at them, for example. Another thing is when they went to battle against another clan of samurais, at the end there was sort of, when they came home with their prisoners, there was a bit of a ceremony to their shogun saying, look, these are your prisoners. And the men were tied according to their rank and depending if they wanted to honor them or humiliate them. The women, on the other hand, side, were tied to enhance their beauty. Because the more beautiful they were, the more they would get rewarded by their shogun. Look what I got back for you. And at the same time, if they'd captured the lady of the house, it was a way to let her know that no matter who she was in her previous household, now she belonged to him.
Wow.
So there's another of submission and all of this.
Yeah.
So all of these elements sort of come into today's rope in one shape or another, or one form or another, and consciously and subconsciously they're all there. They're aesthetic values, their power exchange values, their submission values, and all of this sort of permeate in today's rope. And you've got to understand that every single clan of samurais had their own style of rope. So the rope done in Osaka was different from the rope done in Tokyo, that are different again from Kobe to Kyoto, wherever it sort of came from. Now, what happened is that the emperor realized that if three warlords got together and decided to go against him, his army wouldn't stand a chance, because the samurais were far better than his army. So that is when, I have to make a preface, that Japan was a very closed society. No one was allowed to go overseas, and no foreigner were allowed in Japan. They would get decapitated. Okay, the only ones that had interaction with overseas was the emperor and a few of his cronies. And they were also the ones that that managed the importation of iron, which was such a valuable material. So the emperor, when he realized that he was so vulnerable to the shoguns, and their shoguns were getting more and more powerful, that is when he made a deal with the English and the Portuguese to allow them to trade with Japan in exchange for them selling him guns. Because it was only with guns that he would have a chance to beat, his army would have a chance to beat the samurai at a distance.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened is overnight the samurais were outlawed. So from being noble, sort of, or not noble, but respected in society, they became outlawed overnight. They were supposed to hand in their swords, and they had two swords, a long sword and a short sword. And they had the option to go and work for the emperor, join the army. So most of them refused, obviously, because they were also very proud. Mm. And they went into hiding. And they have, so they say, evolved in what is today the Yakuza. And hence, that is why the Yakuza, that's known as the Japanese mafia, because they were outlawed, are even today in Japan, there's a form of respect towards them. Everybody knows where they are and who they are and what they do, but even the police won't interfere with them unless they sort of create too much trouble. And the Yakuza run all of the underground businesses, illegal businesses, but also some pretty legitimate businesses throughout Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's more or less the story.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you. I haven't never heard that story.
Yeah.
Oh, that's super cool. Yeah. And is it, because I can imagine it being quite underground, you know, Shibari for a long, long time. And I know here too. Do you think that's kind of losing that that title?
Yeah, it has. Because what happened then was it reemerged in the 1930s with an artist called Ito Seyo, who was a very prolific artist with woodcuts, etc., and early photographer. He was also a very nasty individual in the sense he was a sadist. So his woodcuts are very famous, and there's one of his, which is this pregnant woman hanging by the ankles, plunged in an icy lake.
Wow.
Actually, his wife and how he succeeded to kill her.
Wow.
He really wasn't a nice person, but his art and his thing sort of reignited this interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then was picked up by a number of people that went back and started doing research on the local samurais or their styles or their ropes and finding material to rekindle and regenerate. And it evolved in two fronts. One is in Hojujitsu, which is a martial arts with rope, and the other one was sort of going into the BDSM sort of kind of scenario, the sadists and masochists and in that world. So it was very underground, and it still is, you know, relatively underground in Japan. But throughout the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s, it sort of then evolved into a bit of a performance art. So there's a lot of theatres throughout Japan that were doing shibari performances. And then these sort of masters emerged from it that started their own ryus or schools of their own styles, a bit like in martial arts. Okay. And so it sort of went in sort of parallel ways as martial arts has evolved. Now, it is still relatively underground. However, in the last sort of decade or so, it's been picked up throughout all around the world, and through Japanese masters also traveling and teaching workshops around the world, it has reignited interest throughout the general population. Obviously, sort of has attracted kinky people more than anything, but I think it sort of came out of the pure BDSM scenario. So yes, it has evolved, and then there's more artistic expressions have come out of it. There's a lot of people sort of hooked onto the beauty and the aesthetics of it. So a lot of photographers started getting involved because of the just the sheer beauty of it. So there's a lot of different facets now that are expressing it all around.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I just want to say when I see you two performing together, you truly do make magic. I can't imagine you two not performing together. So I want to take the light onto Jenna now and just understand, you know, your journey with this. You know, how did you find rope, or how did rope find you?
I think I was probably looking for it and it also found me. So I was thinking about shibari before I met Avalon. So my rope journey has been 5.5 years now. It seems like it was a baptism by fire, meeting Avalon. But I was teaching yoga at a festival and he was teaching rope, and we met there, and I was tied for the first time, and I just had this incredible feeling of surrender. So for me, it was very much around that aspect, and that's what drew me into beginning, more so than the BDSM side of things. I think I grew into that over time. And that might be shocking to hear for some people if you've seen some of the images that we have as well, but experiencing pain and those kind of things was something that I was not interested in at all in the beginning. So it's certainly been a journey. It's very different now for me than from when I first was getting tied, because I also tie now.
Yeah.
So it's like there's definitely some of the mystery has gone, because I understand the engineering, and I'm Avalon's apprentice in a way, so I know the way he thinks, the way he moves, and because we're in relationship, there's an anticipation that I know now. So one thing with any of our performances, it's completely improv. Nothing is planned. Maybe we know the music and the outfit, and then it's literally like, I am a canvas, paint me with your rope. And he has to plug into me to feel what I can handle in that moment. And then we're off on a journey. So it's completely raw when you see us perform. Which is always fun and interesting. But I think it's probably harder now for Avalon to tie me, because I know a little bit more about, well, I know a lot more now about what is happening. So it's also more of a practice on my side as well to stop thinking about the engineering and just being physical sensation and feeling.
What has shibari brought into your life since you've gone there more on a into deeper practices and working more closely together and being in a relationship? What has it brought into your life?
Oh my gosh. It's a big question. I think it's brought a lot of love into my life, actually. And I think it's taught me a lot about myself. So one thing in rope, I can never lie in rope. So what I mean by that, as soon as rope is on my skin, whatever I am feeling on the inside will come out. It's quite a challenging experience to be in rope, but just the act of trusting someone else to tie you, and there's always communication happening with the tension of the rope, is that it's taught me how to be really honest, because if I'm not feeling it, I have to call it. Otherwise, it's not going to be a good session, and that's not fun for anyone. And I have a responsibility to take care of my own self, that I will communicate if something is right or not right. So I think it's helped me a lot with my communication, actually, to speak up. And so, for example, we might have an hour or 2 hours and we're like, finally, let's go do some rope. And when we're not teaching or something like this, and then we go and start and we're both not feeling it, and we're like, Netflix and chill. Netflix. And it's really important that if that's coming up, that you honor that, because if you push past and keep tying when you're not feeling it, it's just going to suck, and then you won't want to do it again, and it will be a compounding thing. So we're very much about learning how to communicate what's going on for you in the moment, kind of for safety as well as taking care of your own emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And life's very, very fun with Avalon in it.
One of the things that is often misunderstood, rope is not about applying a pattern to a body. Okay. There are a number of patterns, but it is more about tying in the right way for that moment. So, for example, there's only about, I don't know, 100 or so known patterns in the Japanese rope. And however, for each one of those patterns, there's probably 1,000 different ways you can tie. And that's where the variety comes. That is where you tie for the moment. So establishing and understanding how to tie your partner is the key element. Okay? Not how beautiful the rope looks, not how bad the pattern is. That's totally irrelevant.
Okay?
It is really how can you deliver that experience to somebody. And that comes from reading the body language, reading the keys. And if you are, and that's why it takes years to be good at it, because you have to be able to tie without thinking about your rope. You are just focusing on your partner. You're reading your partner. You're plugging into every single cue that their body language expresses.
Yeah.
And Jenna said, the body language can't lie.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So that's when you get a really deep and profound and intense experience. That is the reason why you can have that with your partner and with a total stranger, because you're relying on what these messages are. Of course, with your partner, you know a bit more, you know a little bit, and you've experimented, you know, to a certain degree, and you can push a bit more and you can test certain things, and you wouldn't do that with a stranger. But you can still give a stranger a very intense experience, okay?
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it, is understanding that it is not about the rope. The rope is simply... Yeah.
And I think the other thing that I've learned as someone who also ties, it's been such a great practice to smash my ego. And what I mean by that is, when you're tying for someone, it's not about you. It's always about the other person, and really trying to tune in to where they're at, very much like plugging into an electrical socket. And then there's this exchange of energy that happens. And also, if I'm in like a really fun, tough mood and I want to tie that way, but the person that I'm about to tie is in a really soft mood, I have to let that go and tie for the person. So that I think was tricky in the beginning while also learning how to tie.
Yeah.
It's a really great practice of letting go of your ego.
Yeah. And also as someone who's been tied, from my experience, is also that complete trust that you have in that rigor to let go. And for someone like me that likes to be in control and to know what's coming ahead or how do I should be feeling or prepare myself, you really can't prepare yourself. You just got to completely surrender and just be and just, yeah, let go. It's such a beautiful experience. But also to have the right facilitator, that right person that can guide you on that journey is super important.
Well, trust is a fundamental issue, okay? Mm. If you don't trust the person who's tying you and you're not enough to relax and let go and let your body flow with it and get out of your mind and into your body, you basically defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Okay? So it is really important that if one wants to get tied, they do a little bit of homework to make sure that, you know, the person knows what they're doing and, you know, are safe, you know. And this is over and above all kinds of, you know, consent and other things, because when someone gets tied and has that amount of trust, they are extremely vulnerable. So as a rigger, as the person being tied, that there are some lines and some things that you must never, ever, ever cross.
Mm-hmm.
Because the moment you betray that trust, you'll never get it back, nor you should probably. Okay? Mm. Even if sometimes people do that by mistake, well, that's usually mistakes, rookie mistakes, made by people that are tying well over above their skill sets. To give you an idea, in Japan, an apprenticeship rigger is a 7-year process.
Wow.
In the West, you get someone who's been doing rope for 6 months and they're teaching.
Or one workshop.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're suspending. Like, yeah. This rush to suspension, like as if it was the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
The reality, of course, suspension is sort of spectacular. It's beautiful. And that's why you see a lot of it, is because if you're doing a performance, obviously suspension is far more interesting for people to watch rather than having two people groveling on the floor, right?
Yeah.
And the same with photography. So there's a lot of imagery linked to suspension, a lot more than rope work done on the floor, which is called floor work, okay? However, in reality, when you're interacting with someone and more when you're playing with your partner, 85% of the time it's floor work, because that is where the real connection happens.
Mm.
When there's suspension, there is so much of the rigger's mind has to be on safety, on weight loading, on all these factors, and all of that is detracted from his energy in interacting and plugging into their partner.
Mm.
So it's when it comes to play with your partner, suspension is not where it's at, okay? Suspension is the showy part.
Mm.
However, there is this idea or this image that if you're any good, you will suspend, which is absolute rubbish.
Right.
There's a lot of masters that never suspend or suspend, you know, very rarely, simply because they don't do performances. They do sessions and they do rope work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And their rope, like Yukimura Haruki was one of the masters I studied with, which unfortunately passed away a few years ago. He was the absolute master of floor work, of engaging with someone. And Jenna was lucky enough in 2016, I think, or something like that, to be tied by him.
Mm.
And he was, you know, he did suspend in his, when he was sort of younger and did things, but he was famous for his floor work.
Mm.
But unfortunately, now, because there's so many images about suspension, everybody's rushing into suspension, and that's where the problems sort of arise.
It's really easy to get injured if you're tying with someone who doesn't know what they're doing.
I can imagine. Yeah. You guys are doing some great things in the community, so let's talk about that. Yeah, because I know recently you had a date night workshop or a performance, or what was it, just a date night? Wasn't a workshop. Was it a workshop?
It was a, let's say, a suggestion.
An event. It was a date night event.
Huh? So how date night was born is we're, 7 months into being at home now. We have this COVID situation.
We're locked down.
We are. So we were thinking, what would we like? We'd love to dress up, and well, I would. and make a beautiful space and just have some time where we're dedicating it to each other rather than just going through the motions of daily life and work and these kind of things. And because we love facilitating and creating experiences for people, and we've also previously had our couples courses, which is one of my favorite, we were like, let's create an evening that is an excuse for people to have fun and connect in a similar way that we did. So we set it up. It was so awesome and fantastic for anyone who's an experienced player, someone who's completely new, had enough that they could create a really fun experience with their partner.
Yeah.
So we'll do that again.
Yeah, well, we do a lot of teaching and have been doing for a number of years now. And so we've regularly had, you know, live weekly classes for rope and workshops. We've also been hosting Japanese masters in Melbourne and throughout Australia. We've been traveling around the world doing workshops from all over, you know, around Europe and France and Switzerland, in the UK, in Italy, in China, in Hong Kong,
in Taipei,
New Zealand, and all around Australia. So we've all, you know, teaching and spreading the ropey love, as I say,
yeah,
is something that we do. We've been doing for a number of years now.
Mm.
With this COVID happening, we sort of found ourselves that we had to sort of stop all of that. And so we sort of turned to the online options. So we run weekly classes online, just to, from beginners to intermediate classes. We started Meet the Master. And Meet the Master is an event where we invite one of the Japanese masters to talk about themselves, a little bit like as we're doing today, you know, talk about their philosophy, their rope journey. Then they end up doing a bit of a demonstration, and it's all done online on a Zoom platform. So it has actually given a lot of people the opportunity to spend some time up close and personal with these masters, which would be practically impossible to have.
Mm-hmm.
I took advantage of the fact that they were available. They were in lockdown as well.
Yeah.
So they weren't going, because normally all of these masters are very busy, so it's very hard to lock them down. So to have them speak about themselves and their history and see something has really been an eye-opening exercise, even for ourselves. And we've been going there, and some of them I've known for 10 years or more, and I've learned things about them and their philosophy that I had no idea. Because even if you go to Japan, you might see them in a performance, you might meet them, you might even go out for lunch or dinner with them.
Yeah.
But it's really difficult to have time where you sit down and say, well, tell me your story.
With a
translator.
Yeah.
All. So that's one event that we've been running, and we've hosted, probably a dozen masters, and it's going through. Then we're running out of serious masters. But it's been fascinating. So that's one thing, another thing we've done online. And then some of these masters have been hosting workshops, so a series of 4 or 5, which are actual classes. So you learn certain things about their style, and we're in the middle of a couple of those.
Privates online.
And then we do private classes online.
Yeah.
And we will be starting a series soon, which is run by Jenna, called Women of Kimbaku.
Oh, beautiful rope.
Because there's a lot of women out there that do beautiful rope and they teach and they perform, etc. But as women are a little bit more private, they don't need as much, they don't need to show off as much. So they're actually not so public, but there's some beautiful rope done by women all around the world. And so we'll be hosting a series of Women of Kimbaku, showcasing women and their story and their thing from all around the world.
It's going to be great.
Yeah. Well done. I love that.
So yeah, we've been very busy and that's the sort of what COVID has brought us to this, which has been very fascinating.
Yeah. And I'll put this all into the show notes as well. If people want to connect with you or work with you, see where you're up to, they can find you because I know you're very active on social media. So I do encourage all my listeners to definitely follow you and see the work, the amazing work that you're doing. And I am truly grateful that I can call you my friends and I can hang out with you and play, even though it's been a long time since we've played. But I look forward to that day that we can hang out and do a session and just play around. And it's always so much fun, always so revealing and, playful.
You're a testament yourself. You've tried it and wants more, and that's exactly what.
Definitely want more.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful way to interact with someone. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I've had you both tie me actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did a tandem tie as well, I think.
Mm.
Yeah,
and then I think the last tie was it you did it for me, Jenna. Last catch up. Yeah.
So you're ready for more.
I'm ready for more. Yeah, I just can't wait to. Yeah, lockdown is over, and I'll be definitely coming up to play.
Yeah,
soon.
So where to from here? I know, Jenna, you're going to be running your these workshops very soon for women.
Mm-hmm.
So proud of you. But yeah, where to?
It's just like it's an online talk. It's
online talk.
Same format as Meet the Master, but it's with the women, and so it's just getting to know the women.
Okay.
He facilitates all the workshops. I show up.
Yeah, there might be, as we do with some of the Japanese masters, some of them then eventually come back as a workshop. So that may happen with some of the women as well. But the series is just to meet them, just to hear about them, listen and talk about them, their journey, their philosophy, see a demo of their rope.
Oh, so yeah. I want to do that. I want to attend that.
Yeah. To them.
Yeah, great. Oh, such a pleasure to have you both on the show. Is there anything that I haven't covered that you perhaps want to mention?
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you for
such a beautiful host. We really appreciate it. Maybe one thing that we haven't said, that when permitting, of course, with all the restrictions, if anyone wants to experience what it's like to be tied, they can book a session in with Avalon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, because we host workshops, private lessons, especially for experienced riggers. We do not do that online or in a group, you know, when it comes to sort of more technical things. I believe it should be done as they do in Japan in a one-on-one private session.
Yeah.
And then we do sessions for anyone that wants to experience being tied. With or without photography, so they have something to post on the social media.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's a good point. I should have mentioned that, the private sessions, because I know Well, for me personally, I'm speaking from my experience. It was a very, very healing experience. And I know a lot of people go and have these sessions with you to overcome, perhaps if they had sexual trauma as well.
Not necessarily. Look, the reality is I have a very entrenched belief that I don't do rope for therapy.
Okay.
This for this reason, because I'm not a qualified therapist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I would feel a quack if I did.
Mm.
However, it has been a healing process for many, but that is comes from within.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would love to say I do. But I am not a qualified therapist. Mm-hmm. I've studied sociology and I've studied a number of things and I have great interest in it, but I need to keep it real as far as what I can promise and deliver.
Mm.
I'd feel like I'd be taking advantage of people if I promoted it as a healing, as a qualified healing process.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah.
You know, when I do have sessions with people, I actually have long conversations with them prior to the session to establish and for me to understand where their headspace is and where it is and what they expect from it and what, you know. But I do personally, I don't like to promote myself as a therapist because I'm not and mm-hmm. I feel a quack. And there's unfortunately a few people that do that.
Yeah, yeah, there are.
And I'm actually against it, so.
Check credentials first.
Yes, always. Yeah.
But it can be a very cathartic experience. And mainly I recommend it to people that find it hard to let go, because that's one of the beauties of that experience is going through. Especially for people that are always in control and always need to be in control and are managing people and are doing things, it is a very rare opportunity for them to say, you know, I don't need to be in control in this moment. I can actually let go.
Mm. Right?
Mm. So without getting into too many details, but I have had a number of very powerful women or people come to me for that.
Yeah, was I one of them?
Why we like it well, so much?
Only joking. I'm not that powerful.
No, but that's one of the aspects that yes, that in that case, that can be very, very, mm-hmm. very cathartic and
yeah,
if you like to call it therapeutic, it is. But
yeah,
more than that, I sort of get a little bit reluctant to.
Mm.
Does it make sense? Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, thanks, guys, for coming on.
Pleasure. I'm
waiting to see you both next and just wrap my arms around you both.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. We've met you. So yeah. We'd love to see you.
Mm. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Give you huge kisses and hugs and lots of ropey hugs soon.
I'll take all that.
Perfect.
How gorgeous are those two? Please support them on social media and share the Shibari love. If you do lock in a session with Avalon, I want to hear all about your experience. 50 Shades of Grey, move over. Okay, my review of the week goes to Dee. Dee writes, love this podcast, always bringing such interesting topics to the conversation. Every episode leaves me with a little gold nugget so I can take into my everyday. Thank you, Sharon, for bringing such interesting conversations to us. Oh, thank you, Dee. Loving your support. If you want to continue supporting my work, you can leave me a review on iTunes and it could be you that I acknowledge next week. As always, so much gratitude to my guests and listeners. Without your continuing support, I would not be here. Being of service to you is the greatest. I love it. I feel so blessed that I get to cover the topics that I cover. How bloody lucky am I? All right, on that note, lots of love. Have a great week.